Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Saleh Report. It is my absolute honor this week to introduce you and to welcome to the Saleh Report one of my favorite writers and certainly favorite biographer of all time, Peter Guralnick, who is one of America's most prominent music writers and historians. He has written many books. Let me just mention a few. He has a marvelous trilogy on American roots music, Sweet Soul Music, Lost Highway, and Feel Like Going Home. His biographies include Robert Johnson, one on Robert Johnson, a new or recent one on Sam Cooke, and then a two-volume biography of Elvis Presley. First volume is called Last Train to Memphis, and the second, Careless Love, which I read in the 90s, and consider absolutely as fine as biographies as have ever been written, but marvelous insight, not only clearly the best books ever written by Elvis, but marvelous insight into the history of America and the history of American music, and not to be missed if you like to read. I can't recommend him enough. As I said, a biography of Sam Cooke, but he has written and co-produced a documentary on Sam Phillips called Sam Phillips, the Man Who Invented Rock and Roll, about Sam Phillips, the founder of Sun, and is currently working on a biography, which I can't wait to read. He blogs at his website, petergirlnick.com, and teaches creative writing during the spring semester at Vanderbilt. So, Peter, it's an honor to have you on the Saleh Report. Welcome.
Well, thanks so much. I really appreciate that. I don't know if I can live up to the introduction, but I'll do my best.
Well, it was funny. I was, you know, because we're going to talk today about creativity in writing, creativity in music, and broaden out to how that creativity impacts a wider creativity in our society. And as I was looking at my notes for this discussion with you, I realized, you know, this man is an entrepreneur because he had a passion and a love, and he created a whole business. And you know, I don't think you apparently never went out and got a job. You kind of just invented your work out of this passion. So you seem to know how to invent your world as well. But start us off with how this started. How did you become a person who really documents and builds the history around this extraordinary period of American music? How did this begin? How did you start?
Well, really, it was out of love of the music, and when I was around 15, I just fell into the blues, and there's no real explanation for it. A friend of mine and I were exposed to some blues records. His brother had gone to the Newport Folk Festival in, I think, 1959 or 60, and came back with some records, and we listened, and we just flipped over the blues. And that led me to absolutely everything. And eventually, I mean, I always wanted to be a writer. My two ambitions, my only two ambitions in life were to be a writer and a baseball player. And I carried each of those as far as my talents could take me. And the writing about music was not part of my plan at all. It just wasn't in my plan to write about music at all. I wrote my first novel when I was 18. And I still write fiction. I still write short stories and novels, and that was what I thought I'd do. But when I had the opportunity, when sort of the underground press first started up, when rock magazines, when Crawdaddy started up, and I guess I was, you know, maybe around 25, 26, 27, let me back up on that. I was around 23 or 24 at the time, and I was invited to write about this. Everybody knew, anybody who knew me knew how much I loved the blues, knew how much I loved Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and Lightnin' Hopkins and this whole range. And so I was invited both by this kid that I knew, Paul Williams, who had started Crawdaddy, and then by Boston After Dark, which became the Boston Phoenix, to write about some of these people, and really to write about them as an advocate. And that's what I did, and that's how I started writing about music. But from the beginning, I mean, I guess this is really what made a difference, was that rather than seeing it as a, I would have to say that I saw it as an avocation, not as a job, not as a vocation. It was an avocation, and it was just to have the opportunity to tell people about this music I thought was so great, to tell them about James Brown's show or about Howlin' Wolf or about Muddy Waters. This, to me, was just a tremendous privilege. And what I was writing was just an attempt to persuade people or to inform people about something that they might be missing out on. But it never occurred to me from that time till to this to write about anything that I didn't care passionately about. And I guess that's if there's any path to, if there is a career and if there's any path to the career, that's what the path is.
Well, one of the things that has always amazed me about your writing is that you have the ability to spend the time to dig out the facts. So you know, many times when I've read authors who are very excited about this kind of music, they don't take the time to sit down and reach back into somebody's past and get enormous amounts of sort of detail about their history. You know, this is a whole part of our history that we've never done a good job at sort of archiving and documenting. And you seem to have enormous patience to do that and dig that out without in any way distracting from your love and your passion for the music and the artists and the musicians who are doing it. And so I said to you earlier, you know, you seem to have a strong right brain and left brain, but I think it's the extraordinary attention to the facts and the detail, you know, the effort to be a true historian, that then, you know, from that emerges a much deeper, richer picture of the different musicians and also the time. You know, I know you spent how many years did you spend writing Last Train to Memphis?
I think I spent, it came out in 94, and I started at the beginning of 88, so I spent about 6 years on that, and I spent, you know, another five writing Careless Love. So, I mean, all in all, the Elvis took about 11 years of just focusing pretty much exclusively on that. But I think that, you know, it wasn't so much that I set out to do this particular thing. It was just the idea that context was not everything, but it was context. You can't understand anything without understanding the context. I mean, if we were to continue this conversation, you know, off the radio, really the way we would necessarily want to communicate is to understand the context in which each of us came to whatever point we're at and what the context of our lives is. Otherwise, we just wouldn't have any basis. We would just be talking about, well, I like this and you like that. But the question is, who are we talking to? And that was really, from the very beginning, what I was trying to do. I mean, when I was writing these profiles of Muddy Waters and Johnny Shines, what I wanted to do as much as possible, it wasn't as possible then, or at least I didn't see framework for it as fully as I do now, but I wanted to understand the world from their point of view. I wanted to understand the music from their point of view. I wasn't interested in imposing my own perception on what they did. I wanted to get, you know, what their perception was. Yeah,
right.
To start off with, I admired that music. I admired that spark of creativity. I admired that drive. And that's what I was trying to do in these profiles that I wrote in Feel Like Going Home and Lost Highway, which for the most part are kind of confined to the single person. I mean, there are other people that I speak to, you know, in the course of writing the profile, probably not as many as I should. But it was just the idea of trying to understand what was the world like that you came up in, asking, well, when the Second World War broke out. I mean, this was sort of an interesting question and one that I continued through the Sam Cooke one. But when the Second World War broke out, I mean, how did that change your lives? Well, it didn't change their lives at all, because mostly I was speaking to African Americans who saw the war, I think, as something completely off stage in terms of what they were doing. They were dealing with their own problems, fighting their own battles, and Muddy Waters was a tractor driver. I think that's what it was, and was exempt from the draft, and, you know, but it really meant very little to them. whereas I thought I was asking a hugely significant question, and it was for many people, but not for the world in which they lived.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that's so beautiful about Last Train to Memphis is that you literally, I kind of fell into the book, and before I knew it, I was in the 50s. I could smell the food, and I could hear the music, and I could feel what it felt like. You know, it was a time that felt enormously different than our lives do now. And the context was extraordinary because you're capturing the culture that both produced Elvis and then the one he contributed to mightily. And the, you know, sort of the integration of these different traditions that came together in him and his life and his music. And you feel all of that kind of come together. So it's part of what makes it such a great biography, because you're kind of tapping into this, you know, where did this come from? Where did this amazing music and phenomena come out of? And you bring all those threads together and it works.
Well, you know, part of it, again, was that I mean, what I did in that was something quite different from the earlier books that I had written. I removed myself altogether from it, whereas I'd written more personally about people like Charlie Feathers, or, I mean, about the experiences I had, or Waylon Jennings, or...
Right.
In this case, I removed myself altogether, and I wanted to remain totally in the moment, which required a considerable discipline in terms of a narrative approach, because I didn't want to foreshadow anything, I didn't want to suggest... The whole point of the story of Elvis's early years is that nobody knows how the story is going to come out. I mean, many people have spoken about this kind of thing. I think David McCullough has spoken about it. And, you know, nobody lives in the past. We all live in the present. But the point is, as Elvis is coming along, as he's growing up, as he's developing his ambitions, these unspoken ambitions, as he's growing up, this shy, solitary kid, you know, who can barely play the guitar in front of anybody else, he's harboring these tremendous aspirations. And at the time, there's no way of guessing that it's going to work out for him. He's turned down by the Blackwood Brothers, sort of the junior group of the Blackwood Brothers gospel quartet, because he can't sing harmony, and he's just crushed. And, you know, that he's failed this audition, which is, he thinks at the time is, you know, his last chance at, or one of, you know, his first great chance anyway at fame and musical fulfillment. And then within a month, he's in the Sun studio recording for, or within a month or two, recording for Sam Phillips, and at this kind of audition session. It was really just, it was not going to be a session at all. It was just it was his first full musical get together with Scotty Moore and Bill Black, the guitarist and bass player who played with him as a trio for the first year and a half of his career. And they're just getting together and they're running through songs, and all of a sudden, That's All Right, the Blues by Arthur Big Boy Crudup, he just comes up with it almost out of desperation, and it becomes this huge hit around Memphis and regionally and throughout Texas and Louisiana, and he's on his way.
It's I was just listening to the Sun Sessions this morning in response to something I read on your website, and they're remarkable. Well, I wanted to tell you a story. I once saw an album or a video done of Sting in the late 80s, took a group of artists from very different traditions, Bradford Marsalis from jazz and some folks from reggae and then his own musicians. And he put together a group that did the, I don't know if you remember the Sun album, it was the one with Fragile on it, and he did a 2-year global tour. And so they did a video of this tour, and in the start of it, they're all in a chateau in France, and Sting is very frustrated because all these are very distinctly different traditions and they're not melding. And finally, after much work, they come together and the music sounds quite beautiful. And then at the end of the video, you see them in Tokyo. And what has happened is the musicians have taken the music and gone beyond, and something sort of miraculous has happened well beyond whatever vision he had at the beginning. you know, something else has emerged, and you listen to it and you realize, oh, these guys are helping to invent a whole new culture because they're bringing these different cultures together and they're somehow integrating them and communicating between them. And when I read your work, when you talk about all the African-American musicians during the civil rights movement, and of course, Sam Cooke and Otis Redding, and you see them dealing across these different cultures, whether it's from gospel to secular or from white to black or from South to national, and the same with Elvis bringing in these different strands, including soul music and gospel and into secular. And these guys are forging pathways between different cultures. And somehow I think a lot of times it's always the musicians who build those pathways for us. And I see your work as describing that, you know, in very, very great detail of how that happens, you know, musician after musician.
Well, I think that's true. I think that musicians don't see categories. You know, critics, whether it's literary critics, I mean, you could say the same, I think, of artists of any kind, writers, you know, visual artists. But I mean, nobody is looking to occupy one little square, you know, of the...
Well, I come from the financial world, and everybody's trying to, like, you know, occupy a square and make it their square and not let it bleed into other squares.
Well, I mean, to me, the twin, I guess, ambitions of every musician I've ever spoken to or written about have been to reach the broadest possible audience. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, not to give up one, you know, ounce of their own singularity or particular.
Right.
I mean, Sam Phillips, who discovered Elvis as well as Howlin' Wolf, as well as and recorded B.B. King at the start of his career, and whose label Sun just rocked the world out of a tiny little storefront studio. His great thing was, I mean, he insisted that the one thing that you sought in life, or the one thing you aspired to become in life or achieve, was individualism in the extreme. And from his point of view, every artist that he ever worked with embodied that quality, whether it was Elvis or Rufus Thomas or Howlin' Wolf or Jerry Lee Lewis or Johnny Cash. And I think that all the artists that I've spoken to or that I've met have had that kind of have sought that kind of singularity, but at the same time, they don't see categories, as Sam Phillips did not see categories. And the idea, in a sense, is to create a new ground of their own, just not to see genre, not to see categories, not to make these distinctions which essentially set one off from another. I mean, I'll never forget talking to Ray Charles and asking him what kind of music he listened to now. Now it was, I think, the early 80s at that point. And he said, man, I just love to listen to those Jackie Gleason Presents albums. And I didn't start laughing, but, you know, I mean, there must have been a note of skepticism in my voice, and I'm saying, really? You know, it's just like, he says, oh, man, he says, you know, I could listen to those all day. You know, the sound, the sweet sound of Bobby Hackett's trumpet. And I just thought, you know, this is a lesson for me. You know, I felt like here I'm being so high and mighty, or just, you know, I'm being so snobby in a sense, and thinking Jackie Gleason Presents, you know, he's not serious. But in fact, he was very serious, because he could listen. He could, with what Sam Phillips called ears around, all around his head, without regard to category,
right.
He could hear the sound of that, you know, of that trumpet. Or I remember talking to Howlin' Wolf, and about where he got his howl from, and there were all kinds of African, sort of references that I might have found. There was no question in my mind that he was going to tell me that it was from Tommy Johnson, the blues singer from around Jackson, Mississippi, or from the Mississippi Sheiks. But he says, oh, you know, it was from Jimmy Rogers. He says, you know, that yodel of his. And Jimmy Rogers is, you know, known as the father of country music. And this was without regard. Then Wolf started talking to me about Elvis Presley, about what a great blues singer he was. And, you know, he wasn't speaking, there was nothing ironic about the way he was talking. He was just saying what he felt and speaking about how categories meant nothing. He referred to Elvis as the boy who went to California and made such a success. But it was all built on the blues.
You know, I moved to a small farming community near Memphis in the late 90s. And as I read Last Train to Memphis, I was struck by the power of Elvis's decision, you know, not to go to California, not to go to the East Coast, but to stay in Nashville and do everything in Nashville. And then you combine that with Sun and some of the other things that were going on. And what you realize was there was a renaissance of music. You see that in your trilogy as you talk about Tupelo and Memphis and Muscle Shoals. There was a renaissance that was remarkable. Just, you know, Memphis was an incredible hub. And I, you know, one of the things I would love to talk about is what in the world happened? Because from whether it's the cultural phenomena or the economic phenomena, you're talking about an amazing situation that somehow got lost.
Well, Memphis, of course, I mean, came out of the cotton culture. And it was really the capital of the Delta, not just the Mississippi Delta, but the Arkansas Delta and all of the rural environs. All of that is gone now. I mean, in the sense, I mean, Sam Phillips referred to Memphis as big lights up the river. And that was for, you know, country people, you know, within a 200-mile radius or even a larger radius. And
right.
You had blacks and whites coming there. You had Beale Street, which was like the main street. It was called the Main Street of Negro America. And as Sam Phillips, who first discovered it as a 16-year-old, he had just been heard about it all his life and came into town, and he said the lights of Broadway could never burn brighter. I mean, at 3 o'clock, he came in at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning on his way to a revival meeting in Dallas in 1939. And it was pouring down rain, and he said it was just the street was just so alive with activity. Just every single person who was there, he said, what distinguished it was that every single person who was there because they wanted to be there. And
it's
really true for poor whites as well, for rural whites who would come to Memphis. And it was the center, it was a confluence of black and white culture and black and white music. I mean, you had on the radio, you had the Louvin brothers. You had, I'm not even going to be able to do justice to all the people that you had. I mean, Elvis would go down as a teenager and listen to the Louvin brothers do live broadcasts at noon on WMPS. It was just like a hub of activity of all. So the Louvin brothers are an enormous influence on all the country music that followed, on the Everly Brothers in particular. But the point was that Howlin' Wolf was on the radio at that time from West Memphis. Sonny Boy Williamson was on the radio at that time, first from West Memphis and then from Helena, Arkansas. But you had all of this music was going on at the same time, and all of it was influencing everything else. I mean, Elvis would walk along. I think it was on South Main, but there was a place called the Green Beetle, and he would hear the music coming out of the Green Beetle. Meanwhile, you had all the music that's going on Beale Street, and it just everything was happening simultaneously. And for somebody now. For somebody who was going to close their ears to it because of either its class or its racial origins, and there were lots of people who were not going to pick up on it, then it was meaningless. They were not going to be affected by it. But for anyone who had their ears open, this was like getting a postgraduate education in the music, in music of every sort.
It's funny when I... if you live in the Memphis area, You know, what you know is that Elvis, among other things, was the world's finest local citizen. You know, he did so many things for so many people. And, you know, I've always said the most dangerous thing you could ever do is sit down in the middle of Memphis and say you hated Elvis Presley. Because as we have an expression for that, he needed killing. it would be dangerous. But, you know, there was a time when these folks were, I don't know, they did a great deal to lift up the whole place. And that's why to this day, I still shake my head and say, how did it happen? But I know you spend part of the year every year in Nashville, and Nashville grabbed a hold, not of the, you know, necessarily the rock and roll, but certainly the country part. And I guess it kept going in Nashville as country.
Well, Nashville was a company town. Nashville was a town, you know, in a sense of, you know, made up of Rotarians, and I mean,
right,
in a business sense, and it was, and they organized in a way that, I mean, Macon, Georgia. Look at all the talent that either came out of Macon or passed through Macon, from Otis Redding and James Brown, just tons and tons of talent, but they never developed a sort of, you know, what you would call in another business an industrial core, I think that the likelihood of Memphis, the city, never recognized the music. I mean, they never recognized it while Elvis was alive. They never recognized the music that the success Stax was having. They never recognized the financial windfall or benefits that this music was bringing to the city while it was doing it. So there was never any sense of sort of civic commitment. And you could say it was racial, or you could say it was class, or you could just say it was country club. But the point was, it didn't happen. Sam Phillips used to talk to me about how there was one person at the Rotary Club I guess they had their offices down at the Peabody, where Sam was worked for the radio station WREC, and there was one person, a Mr. Soderson, I think, who was the executive secretary of the Rotary Club, and that's the single person who ever gave him any encouragement within the business community. He got lots of encouragement from people who within the proper Memphis community. He got lots of encouragement from people who lived outside of it. But the other thing about Memphis, and I think this is just an example of, you know, people are always looking for, well, I don't know, for an Achilles heel, I guess, which I think is kind of, it's not a real thing. But the thing about Memphis that so distinguished it in terms of the music that it made was that the music set out to be different from anything else that existed, whether it was because of limitations of musicianship, which, you know, was the case, for instance, with Johnny Cash's, Johnny Cash and the Tennessee Two could barely get through a song when they started out. And Phillips said that's what makes them different. That's what makes them so great. It's the effort that, you know, and it's the simplicity of the music, which is an imposed simplicity, because they couldn't play any differently. But
right.
But all of the music that came out of Sun, the music that came out of Stax, it was really free spirited. Memphis, even outside of that, people like Kemmons Wilson, who started the Holiday Inn chain, or I think the first supermarket, Clarence Saunders was it, who built the Piggly Wiggly chain. But all of these, what Memphis has always taken pride in as a city, is the individualism, the eccentricity, the difference of,
right,
of these difference makers. But what none of them had was the ability to join together to form the kind of civic organization that Nashville did when it, as it became Music City, so-called, in the 50s. And the music that Nashville created in some ways was similar to the music that Berry Gordy created in Motown, it was modeled in a sense on an assembly line prototype. It was the idea that you had one session after another, you had 3-hour sessions of the music, you produced 4 songs, the same players, you know, played on all of these things. They showed tremendous adaptability, but there was always a clock, and the music, at its best, certainly transcended formula, but a great deal of the music was intended to sound like a great deal of the rest of the music, and that was just never the case in Memphis.
Well, I know one of the things I really value about living in that area is, you know, before then I lived on the East Coast and went to an Ivy League university, and everybody's expected to know, you know, you're expected to know the answer. And instead around Memphis is a culture where it's fine to say, I have no idea. What do I do? You know, you have permission to be stupid, which as an entrepreneur is essential, because you can't figure something out unless you can first start by saying, I have no idea. Do you understand this? You know, so it's funny. It makes learning easier. So it's in that sense, I find the South much, you know, a much sweeter place to learn and try things and to innovate. So one of the things I'd mentioned to you, we just talked on the Soleri Report about a wonderful PBS documentary called Music Makes the City. And about sort of the alignment that happened in Louisville around their orchestra. And you see the different sectors within the city support each other. So the artists and the business community, and they just had a great mayor. So, and were able to do very extraordinary and innovative things. And I think that's one of the things I think about. And one of the reasons I so appreciate many of your books is you get into that. What takes us from an extraordinary musician to a cluster of musicians to someone like a Sam Phillips, who makes it possible, you know, who has that vision and brings it all together so that the music can really get recorded and packaged and distributed. And that's that piece that Phillips has done, which I think is so special. Now, you're working on a book about Phillips, so I want to read this. When is it going to be available?
Next year. I mean, I'm working on the fourth and what I fully intend to be the final draft, and hope to get it in by the end of the summer, by September, and then have it come out next year. So
it was really funny when I was reading your trilogy. I was re-looking at the trilogy this weekend, and as I was going through it, I kept jumping up and going over to the computer to pull up on YouTube that sound or that artist. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, it's too bad you can't make this a multimedia thing. And then I emailed you, and you came back and said, make sure you look at the enhanced video version on Kindle. And I went in and realized, oh, you've done this.
Well, to a degree, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's just, no, I love, I think of both, I think Elvis Costello and Roddy Doyle both said, they might have said it about sweet soul music, but basically what they said was how they had great quotes about how much they enjoyed the book and loved the book. They said, but be prepared, you know, to dig deep into your wallet to go out and find all this wonderful music that's being written about. And then that really is, you know, my aim is that I'm writing about something that I think is great art. And maybe that's pretentious, and I don't mean to make it into a...
Oh, it's to me, it's as great as art has ever been done.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, so whether it's Robert Johnson or it's Howlin' Wolf,
yeah,
or Elvis or James Brown, but the point is that you want to, this should send you to the music. It should it should inspire you to seek out much more than what I'm writing about, because it should inspire, you know, the reader's own quests and the reader's own enthusiasms. And that's very much part of the motivation. But one of the fun things about doing these enhanced ebooks, which so far we've done Feel Like Going Home and Lost Highway, and we're just finishing up Sweet Soul Music and the Sam Cooke biography and the enhanced ebooks of them, is to have conversations with some of the people that I've been friendly with over the years. I mean, unfortunately, so many of them are gone. Solomon Burke would have been the featured conversation in every
year.
Yeah. But the point is to be able to talk with people that I've known over the years, like Sleepy LaBeef or Roland Jaynes or William Bell, or Dan Penn, or Rick Hall, or Elsie Cook, Sam's brother Elsie Cook. I thought this would shed, in addition to, you know, interviews about the book, you know, with me about the books, but to have these conversations with people, not interviews so much as just conversations with Dan Penn about creativity and about the correspondence between songwriting and writing books. And it just, to me, it was really cool, and it was just a wonderful opportunity. And it turned out to be much more work than I thought it was going to be. But
it's a great.
I didn't think anything. It turned out to be a lot of work, but very rewarding work.
I remember when I was in college, one of us, I had another friend who was also loved the blues, and we drove hundreds and hundreds of miles to get to a concert. It was Buddy Guy and B.B. King. Mm-hmm. And I just remember, you know, when they went late into the night, and it was one of those things where it just, you know, it rocks your world. It just, you know, but it was
That's an amazing concert, because I don't know. Maybe they did lots of them together, but I...
No, I don't think so.
But it's because Buddy Guy came up so much under the influence of B.B. King, and then of Guitar Slim in Louisiana, who was really his first hero, and between the two, he sort of got this wild take on B.B. King's sort of single string approach to the blues. Buddy Guy was one of the first blues singers, I think, or one of the first people that I ever interviewed very early on. And but that would be an example. When I talked to him, and this must have been around 67 or so, maybe a little later, maybe 68, but he had just left Chess Records and was on Vanguard, and he was disconsolate in a way that no handler or PR person or publicity director would allow their, you know, their directed star to be today. And you know, I remember talking, because he just didn't know where his career was going to go. He had made this album, which is really a fantastic album for Vanguard, called A Man and His Blues, with Otis Spann on piano, and it's really great. But it's a completely different feeling than the Chess sides, which were just much more intense and sort of frenetic. And he just wasn't sure if he was going in the right direction. And that's mainly, it wasn't a great interview or anything, but it was, that's what we talked about. And that's the kind of thing that I've always wanted. I mean, I don't want to get the downside, but I want to get how people feel and what they're trying to do and what they think they can do. And just, you know, an honest reflection of just as you would with somebody that you met in a social context or in any other context. I mean, talk to people about their work, about the work that they do, how they do it, why they do it. And everybody wants to talk about that. It doesn't matter whether they're an electrician or a mechanic or a blues singer.
Yeah.
I mean, I've rarely met anybody who didn't want to talk about that if you show them the respect that they deserve.
There's a great moment, and I forget which book it in. I think it may be in Lost Highways, where you come upon the realization that you have no interest in being a rock and roll star. Because you realize this is really hard work, life on the road.
Well, you know, I think what it was that it was a sense of, you know, it's not the grass is always greener, but, you know, the sense that you have that somebody else's life is always, that, I mean, I was so admiring of the people that I was writing about. And the realization that I had ultimately was that I did what I did and they did what they did. And I couldn't do anything about the world that I came from any more than they could do anything about the world that they came from. And in other words, we can't change our backgrounds. We just are from where we are. And I think this was really, I don't think I recognized at the time what it was, but in a sense it was an embrace of my own, you know, what I was meant to do. I wanted to be a writer, and that's what I always wanted to be, but in writing about the music, I guess somehow or other, maybe I had an inferiority complex for a while, but not for that long, because eventually I realized, well, this is my mark, in a sense. You know,
right.
Muddy Waters has his mark, and it's one that I admire enormously. But I have my mark too, and I'm not, and there's no reason to feel apologetic, but there's no reason to boast about it, but there's no reason to feel apologetic about it.
So when you are teaching your students at Vanderbilt about creative writing, what do you tell them, what do you teach them about how to find their voice?
That content always trumps style. That this is a very unfashionable view. This is not the thing to add.
Well, because if you look at your content and your success with content, it requires enormous discipline, hard work, and time.
Well, the point is that it's kind of like that they should care passionately about what they write about, and that's really the first thing, and that I'm not going to start worrying about their grammar or their, with the MFA program, these are, graduate students, they're highly accomplished, but it really is, to me, it's of very little consequence to write beautifully about something you don't care about.
And right.
I'm just saying that the two things, I guess, that are just that you've got to really care about what you write about. Consider everything a draft, in a sense. Don't be inhibited by the idea, well, this isn't going to be perfect, because nothing you do in life is ever going to be perfect. And as Sam Phillips frequently said, how boring would that be if it were perfect? But you're always striving for perfection. And I guess the other thing is, with the undergraduates, the thing, because I teach one undergraduate course and one graduate course, but in particular I'll always cite Bob Dylan's line, to live outside the law, you must be honest. And take responsibility for your own. I said, I don't care what you can choose whatever you want to choose. That's your choice. I'm not going to be offended by it. But don't try to put it on me, and don't try to put it on externals, and don't say the dog, ate my brilliant, composition or something. It's just, recognize that you're making your own choices, and be sure those are the choices you want to make. If they're self-destructive, fine. But be sure that's the choice you want to make. Don't try to put it off on somebody else. They're life lessons more than writing lessons.
One of the things that really struck me when I first went to Graceland, and living where I do, I've been there many times at this point. And as you know, with the Sillery production team has been ordered to go. They're going to be off at Graceland and write about it this week as we post your interview. So I'm very much looking forward to that. But one of the things that got me to Graceland the first time was a wonderful reporter, investigative reporter that I knew up in Washington, called me and said, I'm driving to Memphis. I'm going to Graceland. And I said, why? And she said, well, someone asked the estate if they could reissue something by Elvis, and it just hit number one in London, making it, I think, his 21st number one hit, and that means he's got more number one hits than the Beatles in London. And so this was considered very newsworthy in Washington, and so she was being sent to Graceland. And we went, and it was right near the time of his birthday, of Elvis's birthday, and there were just enormous numbers of flowers sent from fan clubs from all over the world. And of course, one of the great things about Graceland is you can, throughout the different parts, there are all sorts of videos that describe different aspects of his work and his movies and concerts. And what you realize was what a global phenomenon he was. And I think at one point in one of your interviews, you were talking about the goodwill that both soul music and Elvis and all this work that you've written and built so many histories for, how much goodwill this work has created globally for America. It's quite phenomenal. I'm sure those artists never dreamed that the world would love America because of their work to the extent I think it has happened. It's quite remarkable. And many of us inside the borders of America, I think, don't begin to realize.
Well, no, it's an astonishing thing. I think that all the good feeling that the music put out in the world, brought out in the world, and the way in which people who don't speak English, people who come from completely different cultures, can embrace the blues or could embrace bluegrass music. I mean, look at the current bluegrass in Japan, along with blues. And it points to something, I think, universal about, and I think this was a tremendous, I mean, I remember I included this in the enhanced e-book of Feel Like Going Home. I included 11 or 12 minutes of my original interview with Muddy Waters, and was talking to him about his discovery by a European audience within, you know, relatively recent time. When I interviewed him in 1970, I first interviewed him in 70, and you know, he was just he was in the midst of a sort of global discovery, which kind of astonished him. And when I asked him at the end of the interview, did he have any regrets? He says, "Yeah, I kind of regret that this didn't all happen when I was younger and I could put out more." But but it wasn't a bitter regret, because the point was he embraced the idea that all of a sudden his music had taken on a larger scope, had reached a far vaster audience than he could ever have imagined.
Right.
Down on the Stovall plantation in Clarksdale, you know, or even when he moved to Chicago, or even when he had his first, you know, hits on Chess, which, you know, when Muddy had hits on Chess, you know, in 51, 52, 53, that meant they might have sold 25 or 30,000 copies. That was a big hit.
Right. So let's come up to now. Tell us about music now. Obviously, the internet, YouTube, there's been an enormous change both in the cost of recording and producing, you know, so we've seen the economics change, we've seen distribution change. What do you think is the possibility for young artists today and for the kinds of renaissances that you wrote about in Memphis happening, you know, whether it's in Nashville or any place in America today?
I think, you know, it's almost like there's a duality here, because I think that you're unlikely to have the kind of renaissance that occurred in Memphis or in various other, you could say in Detroit with Motown, in London with the Beatles, or Liverpool. Or I mean, because although on the one hand you now have a global audience almost by definition, on the other hand, everything is a niche music. Everything is a niche, you know, everybody seeks out their own, they rather than when Aretha, I'll never forget when Aretha Franklin's "I Never Loved a Man" came out, and being outside, being in Roxbury in Boston, and outside Skippy White's home of the blues record shop, and the song is coming out over the speaker above the door, and you just have this gathering of people just listening to this music. Well, you don't have to do that anymore. There aren't any record stores anymore. You can listen.
Right.
You know, you can listen in the privacy of your own computer. You don't have to be in your own room, and you can hear anything. And you know, in a sense, everything is available. But it's like you know, going bowling. I mean, you do it alone. I suppose you don't. You could be in a bowling league, but I mean, the point is that there's the sense of community. On the one hand, you know, you can say, well, that community exists through all of the, you know, social networks, but
no, it doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see that. I mean, I just don't see that as a real community in which people interact and in which everybody is listening to the same thing at the same time. So that's the one. On the other hand, it offers tremendous opportunities for the creative person who wants to pursue his or her own vision or his or her own, you know, musically or any other way. And I do think, though, that the absence of any kind of centrality has a number of results. One is that, you know, you'll never have another, or you're unlikely to have another Beatles, Michael Jackson, Bruce Springsteen, Elvis Presley, because where everybody sort of comes together on the same thing.
Right.
The other thing is that I think you've removed the economic structure which, in a sense, supported music. It often, you know, could exploit artists. It could. I don't mean to say it was an all good thing, but the thing is that all art requires patronage of some kind. You know, whether you go back to the Medicis or you get a Guggenheim or you get royalties for the books you write or the songs that you sing. And I think that the internet will erode those both copyright protections and the payment that might once have been expected. And I think that will have a deleterious effect in a sense, not on people creating things for themselves and their friends or their communities, but their virtual communities, but it will have a deleterious effect on the broad possibilities of pursuing a career in the arts.
I know crowdfunding has channeled a fair amount of money to both video games and documentaries, but I don't know if it's channeled much to musicians. Would you know by any chance?
I don't know, no.
It'll be interesting to see if that happens. Well, Peter, I can't thank you enough for everything you do. I think building, I always say history is written by those that archive, and I think the contribution that you've made to digging in and getting the facts and documenting this phenomenal part of American culture and arts is just, I forget who it was who called you a national treasure or a national gem, but I agree.
I think it was a national resource, but I think it might have been better an endangered species, you know.
Well, before we close, is there anything that you would like to add, particularly on the topic of creativity, whether in writing or music or business?
No, I think that the maybe the two things that I thought of were you asked me what I tried to convey to my students at Vanderbilt, and enthusiasm would be the you know, at the heart of it. I mean, I suppose that almost goes without saying, but that would be, and I think that that's from the standpoint of, you know, pursuing a life in writing. I mean, I've never written anything that I didn't want to write. Now I don't mean that as a boast, and that's not an easy thing to maintain, and it has its own downside in a sense. I mean, you have to be pretty resourceful to try to figure out how you can write or pursue exactly the path you want to pursue. But to me, that really is at the heart of everything that one should be seeking. You have to put food on the table. You don't want to see your kids starving, you know. But fundamentally, you should be pursuing your own vision. The other thing that I think, you know, in speaking of creativity, is to me, what I've written about, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, it's intended to be responsive to human concerns, human needs, human concerns, human joys, human sorrows. And one of the things that I think has been most valuable to me in my writing, whether fiction or nonfiction, has been the things that I've done altogether outside of writing, in terms of experience, in terms of getting a broader range of human experience than if I were living you know, in an ivory tower or an academic setting or, you know, something like that. And I feel like it was invaluable to me for about 20 years, about 22 years, I think. I ran a camp, children's camp, boys' camp, that my grandfather had started. And like so many things in my life, I fell into it.
It was in New Hampshire, right?
That's right. It was on Lake Winnipesaukee in East Alton. And the thing was, I did it because I was very close to my grandfather. He asked me to help him, and then he got sick, and I ended up doing it. But the thing was that it exposed me to such a range of it required so much more of me, and it exposed me to such a range of experiences and people, and whether it was, you know, a matter of building tennis courts or getting a new hot water heater or getting the, you know, or a Hobart dishwasher or dealing with all these different people and dealing with practicalities, figuring out how to do a budget, how to reward people, reward the staff with as high a salary as I could, without just sinking the entire enterprise, which everybody was so committed to. And
well, it gives you a sense of how extraordinary what Sam Phillips accomplished was, because he had to do it in the context of all these different extraordinary tensions of class and race.
And with no money of his own, and essentially having to try to figure out how can I survive in this and still hold on to my dream, to my ambition, to everything which I believe, which was the kind of music that he made, which nobody else had made up until that time. I mean, that mix of black and white. And he had two nervous breakdowns. He had shock treatments each time. I think 8 shock treatments each time. But he persisted. And when I met Sam Phillips for the first time in 1979, I'd been trying for over 10 years to get together with him to do, and finally his son Knox was able to set up an interview. And Sam didn't do any interviews at that time. And when I met him, and it's the last chapter in Lost Highway, and he preached to me, and listening to him, it was one of the most inspiring things in the world, because essentially what he was talking about was how to live your life. And so many of the ideas that he articulated so eloquently had to do with the things that I was trying to do at camp, say. And I just thought, oh my God, this is just so extraordinary. Not that it matches my experience, but that it articulates and sets goals that I could embrace. And so to me, that was just. And then I knew him for 25 years after that, and continued to be. He was one of the most charismatic people, as were Solomon Burke and lots of other people. But but just one of the most charismatic people I've ever met. But the point was, he took this seriously, and he recognized all the different things that he had to balance and juggle in order to do what was, more precious than, or as precious as life itself to him, which was make that music.
Wow. So I interrupted you on the camp. So your second point was...
The other thing was that going out, had I just sat back, which I never could have done or would have done, sat back and written about the music from a sort of an armchair written my views, my judgments, my criticisms, graded the music or something like that. To me, that it held no attraction and it has no particular relevance to me. But the point was to go out and to meet all these different people, to meet D. Ford Bailey, to meet Waylon Jennings, to meet Solomon Burke, to meet Sam Phillips, and to go out and, in a sense, to enter into their world, to be welcomed into their world so generously by so many different people from so many different backgrounds, just expanded my world in so many different ways. It created a so much larger context than anything I could ever have gotten by, dwelling on my own thoughts or opinions or experiences. And I feel like it expanded the horizons for everything that I wrote, for the novels that I was writing, and ultimately for these biographies of Elvis, of Sam Cooke, of Sam Phillips, where essentially what I tried to do was to portray a world, a much wider world. I tried that to an extent also in Sweet Soul Music, which I sort of conceived of as a narrative history, but to give a sense of that broader world, of a world in which there's all this ferment and creativity, and there are all these connections which the people living in that world recognize, but the people who are outside of that world would be unlikely to ever perceive or experience unless they're brought into it. So I tried to bring them into it.
Well, you paint a picture of the people who create our world. It's quite remarkable. So, Peter Gerlinek, thank you so much. Have a wonderful day, and thank you for joining us on the Solarity Report.
Well, thanks. I've really enjoyed it, and I've just really enjoyed it. Thanks a lot.